This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The payment pause on student loans has been extended until January 31st, 2022. Later in the show, we'll talk about what options Hoosiers with student debt have. But first, we're joined by Erica Herron, education reporter at the Indy Star, to get an update on Ron Kelly High School's federal case involving the firing of a gay guidance counselor. Thank you so much for joining us, Erica.
Thanks for having me.
Erica, can you explain sort of the background of this case for people who may be hearing about it for the first time?
Sure. This started back in the fall of 2018, actually, with two guidance counselors at Ron Kelly High School. The first was Shelley Fitzgerald. She was suspended that fall, and that's kind of what kicked off a whole series of events that led to the lawsuit we're talking about today, which was filed by her co-director of guidance, Lynn Starkey. Both were eventually fired at the end of the 2018-19 school year because they had entered in, they were both, gay women in same-sex marriages. The Archdiocese of Indianapolis and the high school decided not to renew their contracts because of that, saying they were in violation of a clause in the contract that says they must live within kind of the teachings of the Catholic Church.
And so this is not the first time we're seeing a case like this in Indiana. It sounds like this is one of many now.
One of several. There was also another court case, not in federal court, though, but involving a firing of another gay teacher from Cathedral High School. So three kind of separate cases against the Archdiocese, two involving Ron Colley and one Cathedral High School. The Fitzgerald case is still working its way through the courts, though.
And so right now we're talking specifically, I guess, about the most recent ruling where the judge ruled in favor of Ron Kelly High School. Is that my understanding?
That's correct. Yes. The district court judge, federal district court judge, ruled in favor of Ron Kelly and the Archdiocese, basically saying that they have the right to hire employees that kind of adhere to their faith. It's something called the ministerial exception.
And what exactly is that exception, if you can give us some insight?
Sure. So basically, it just says that these employment discrimination claims, they can't be filed against the church because they have autonomy to choose their leaders, including teachers and guidance counselors, and kind of set the rules for those, and that the they can hire people that adhere to the teachings of their faith. So it's an exception from these kind of federal employment discrimination claims for religious institutions.
And so the guidance counselor was a counselor, I read your article, for about 40 years, and this started happening about a year or two ago. Was there anything that led to it getting to this point?
Yeah, so Lynn Starkey worked at Ron Kelly for almost 40 years, a variety of positions, the last, last one being co-director of guidance. She and her wife were married back in 2015. It wasn't until, though, the 2017-18 school year that she was asked to sign an employment contract that has this ministerial language, that clause in it. And then it wasn't until the next year then that it really became an issue. And it seems like that all kind of started because her co-worker, Shelley Fitzgerald, a parishioner, pulled her marriage license, turned it in to a local priest who then took the issue to the Archdiocese, who then started working on kind of enforcing these clauses in their schools.
Is that even legal to go and pull people's private information? I mean, maybe it's public record, but...
Yeah, I believe that marriage licenses are part of the public record.
Right. I'm just wondering what the precedent is for something like this. I'm not going to try to do like a legal quiz of you right now, but in your experience in covering this story, does this seem to be on par with the usual situation with Catholic schools in Indiana, or is this an anomaly?
So this has certainly happened. Indiana is not the only place that this issue has come up. It certainly was. The Archdiocese of Indianapolis seems to be more aggressive in pursuing these cases or these teachers here and, in the last couple of years than in other places. We had kind of more instances of this happening here than other areas around the country have really seen. But it's certainly not particular just to Indianapolis.
And how have people in the Catholic community reacted since these firings started happening?
It was really divisive for the Catholic community here locally, and not just locally, kind of, you know, around the country, people have weighed in. But you had, you know, a lot of folks who sided with the church and said that, you know, these people aren't either following their in the contract language, or they're not adhering to the Catholic faith. So that the church should have the right to do this, and were very supportive. And you had another group of people, both Catholic and non-Catholic, who were really upset about this and disappointed in the church. There have been folks within the Catholic community, especially young people, really calling on the church to change and become a more tolerant and accepting place of these LGBTQ employees. But so far, you know, the Archdiocese has kind of stuck to its message that it has a constitutional right to hire people that, you know, stick to its teachings.
Right. I just wonder, though, like in jobs like this, if you're signing a contract, it's kind of vague, maybe. And maybe it's up to the, is it the institution that's just deciding what they want to be included and not?
Do you mean as far as like what constitutes a violation of church
teaching?
Right,
right.
Yeah, so that was a question that came up, you know, kind of when all of this started to bubble up too, is what about other, you know, kind of violations of church teaching? And there were some people who said, well, you know, what about a teacher who isn't married but is living with someone, or, you know, hasn't gotten their marriage annulled, that sort of thing. And the church's position largely was that there, if there are other issues, or whenever an issue arises like this, they want to work with their employees first and, you know, kind of try and find some way to ameliorate that situation, either to get them on the right side kind of the church, if at all available. But in these cases, you know, the only way to do that for these folks would have been to end their marriages, and they weren't willing to do that.
If you're listening live and have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Erica Heron, education reporter for the Indy Star, on the recent Roncalli case. Erica, has the church made any official statements about these firings?
The church for the last couple of years has really just been speaking through the group, the legal group that's been representing it. And the like most recent statement they've issued has just been celebrating, you know, their win in this case and their right to, you know, continue to set these kind of rules for employment, and that it really, you know, allows religious institutions to, you know, live up to and fulfill their religious mission.
I also read in your article that they may appeal this case. Do you have any sense that that's going to happen? The woman who was fired?
Yeah, the Lynn Starkey, she actually filed her appeal with the Seventh Circuit yesterday. So that will go to the appeals court now.
Well, since the judge ruled in support of the Archdiocese in Roncalli, does that kind of put a damper on any other cases moving forward? Could that set precedent, do you think?
This particular ruling, so my understanding, and I'm not a legal expert, I'm an education reporter, but my understanding from talking with legal experts is that the actual district court ruling, so this most recent ruling, does not set precedent, but the appeals court decision could in the three-state region that is under its jurisdiction, which is Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. But it does certainly, you know, raise some questions about Shelley Fitzgerald's case, which is, of course, you know, very similar.
And so what does it mean in general when we talk about these sort of contracts? Is that mostly for that teachers have to sign? Because it sounds like it's something that popped up in the last few years. Is this exclusive to Catholic schools, or do you see it in other religious private schools?
We have seen it actually in other religious private schools as well. There was a case at a Lutheran high school last summer where an athletic trainer was also fired because she was gay. It has happened, you know, more at Catholic schools in this area, but it certainly does happen at other religious schools and institutions as well.
And so what are you thinking is the next sort of phase for this case or story that you're covering, if there's an appeal?
So certainly the appeal will be an interesting kind of process to watch because it could set precedent for other cases like it, including Shelley Fitzgerald's case, which is a little bit further behind kind of in the process. Then also the Cathedral High School teacher, his case is also in appeal, he lost his initial case and has since appealed that too. So waiting to see if there's any movement there or if kind of this next level continues to apply the ministerial exception, I think more broadly, at least in this case, than certainly than, you know, Lynn Starkey's lawyer was hoping would happen.
Were there any other examples of employees breaking the agreement that was outside of, same-sex marriages?
No other cases we know of where people have been fired that I'm recently, fired for breaking that agreement.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you giving us the insight. We'll look forward to more of your reporting and the update on the case.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Erica Herron is an education reporter for the Indy Star. We'll be back after a quick break to talk about the extension to the student loan payment pause. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Or you can reach out to us on our app. It's called All in Vox Pop. You can find it anywhere you get your apps, and you can leave us a voice memo that way. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The recent federal decision to extend the payment pause on student loans, what does that mean for folks who still have loans to pay off or will have loans in the near future? We're joined by Damian Dunn, Vice President of Your Money Line, and Andrew Penta, Senior Writer for Student Loan Hero, to learn more about what's happening. Welcome to both of you. Damian, I'll start with you. How did the student loan payment pause come about?
Well, that's a little bit of a longer story, but I'm happy to explain it. Back in March of 2020, the federal government, in all of its wisdom, said, you know what, people are going to need a little bit of relief going forward, some flexibility in their month-to-month cash flow. And they said, here's something that we can do. We can pause the repayment of all federal student loans. And that's exactly what they did. Since then, it's been extended a handful of times since March of 2020. We're looking at maybe the third or fourth extension at this point, and it's set to expire now on January 31st of 2022. Education Department has warned that this will be the final extension, but during that time period, almost 24 months from March 2020 to January of 2022, it'll be almost 24 months. All federal student loan holders have not had to repay their loans, make those consistent monthly payments, nor has interest accrued on those payments as well.
Would this be for folks who maybe have a loan from 10 years ago?
It could be the certain loans. I believe all federal loans may qualify. There may be one or two outliers, but almost certainly everybody who has a federal loan will qualify for this moratorium pause.
I wonder if this is kind of a test phase to see that maybe we need to get rid of student loans in general and just have a free education somehow.
It's an interesting potential transition from where we were to what we have heard calling for over the last number of years, eliminating a great deal of student loans, whether that's $10,000, $50,000, doing away with them completely. There's a much bigger appetite, I feel like, for people to have some relief right now, as things may have been out of their control to make those payments. And we've seen that there may be a little bit of argument or debate on extending timelines occasionally. But when it came down to it, nobody really put up too much of a fight. When it comes to overall loan forgiveness, however, I think we'd see some partisan bickering back and forth to see what is actually, at least how they feel, maybe in the taxpayers and the individual's best interest going forward. I think there might be a happy medium somewhere in there, but that's for the politicians to decide.
Well, Andrew, we mentioned that the federal loan payment pause has happened a few times so far. Is there a possibility, do you think, that it could be extended beyond January?
Yes. Thanks for having me. essentially what the Department of Education and the White House has said is that this will be a final extension on the moratorium of student loan payments. Of course, never say never, particularly with the Delta variant and a potential worsening of the pandemic, where borrowers might continue to see sort of some struggles with resuming their repayment. But yes, the full expectation is that this will be the final extension and borrowers will have to get ready to make their payments come February 2022.
So if somebody's payment is on hold right now because of this pause, do they have to pay stuff retroactively, or is it as if these last year or two it's forgiven?
Yeah, so essentially borrowers will pick up where they left off. So if you had a $15,000 federal student loan back in March 2020, you're going to have at least a $15,000 federal student loan when you pick your repayment back up in February 2022. There was just a recent report from the National Consumer Law Center that showed that some folks who've made voluntary payments on their loans that had outstanding interest and fees, they'll actually return to their a larger balance. But for most part, the vast majority of federal loan borrowers will basically essentially pick up where they left off.
And Damian, what kinds of loans are eligible for this payment plan? Is it only specific types?
Well, in a general sense, it's federal loans. If you have a private loan, a private college loan through an institution outside of the federal government, those were not eligible for this moratorium. The federal government loans, however, that do apply to students and potentially parents as well, those did qualify and were on pause during this time period.
Well, Damian, I mean, if the student loan pause is applying to federal loans, what is out there for people who don't have these federal loans that, you know, they are not getting this benefit of a pause?
They're in a little bit of a tough spot. The thing is, they've been dealing with this ever since everyone else went into this moratorium. So they are going to be still reckoning with trying to make sure their budget is in line and they can still pay these loans. Otherwise, they will have some sort of penalty or, of course, gaining a balance in interest or potentially even going into default on these private loans as well if they weren't able to keep up with them during the pandemic.
And Andrew, are there any concerns that folks will still not be able to pay off their loans even after the pause is over?
Yes, that's absolutely a concern. We recently published a survey on studentloanhero.com that showed that the vast majority of federal student loan borrowers are not feeling confident about their ability to basically make that same minimum monthly payment that they were making in March 2020 and before. Fortunately, there are a pretty wide a menu of repayment options for those borrowers. So when they do resume payment in February 2022, hopefully before then they've set a plan about potentially adjusting their repayment plan or applying for some sort of deferment or forbearance if absolutely necessary to continue a pause on their debt.
And Damian, you know, just for folks who are tuning in and maybe didn't have to take a loan out to go to school, what are these loans generally used for when people need to take them out for school if it's a federal loan?
Any number of possibilities could be tuition, could be room and board, could be books, all sorts of related costs and expenses that go along with the entire college experience that students typically are charged with trying to figure out a way to pay for.
And Andrew, are you hearing from folks that wish that this pause would be extended?
Absolutely. You know, there's millions of federal student loan borrowers who've really relied on this break from their repayment to sort of get the rest of their financial house in order, so to speak, you know, sort of resetting their family budget potentially after, say, a loss of income during the pandemic, or perhaps they've had to face medical bills or other sort of surprise financial responsibilities. And this moratorium on federal loan payments has really given them extra breathing room within their budget. You know, it's not really hard to imagine if you had a federal loan monthly payment of, say, $500 or $1,000, that's that much money left of room in your budget where you can sort of redirect it to where you need it. So certainly many of these borrowers are not excited to resume repayment on their debt. And some of them are even holding out hope for mass student loan forgiveness, though that does seem still pretty far off.
That seems like it might be a tough transition to have this pause and sort of rework, let's say, your budget, and then all of a sudden get smacked back into that payment every month. Damien, are there any smart financial moves folks can make during this pause?
I would take advantage of this potential transition time. We've been made aware that this is the last extension. Of course, as Andrew said, you know, never say never, but I have a feeling this one might stick this time. And if this is for sure the last extension on the pause, we've got a number of months to start getting our budgets realigned, if possible, with what we're going to face going forward in February of 2022. If you've been using the money that you have previously been or were previously putting towards student loans, I should say, in other areas of your life, whether that's emergency savings, whether that's paying down other high interest debt, or saving it for an emergency fund, whatever the case may be, you have a time period to start transitioning, get your budget more in line with what it's going to look like in February than it does right now. And if that means that you slowly but surely start to transition into even just saving the money that you're going to be making towards your student loan debt, that would be a great opportunity to start preparing yourself for the future.
If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're talking about the recent federal decision to extend the payment pause on student loans with Damien Dunn, Vice President of Your Moneyline, and Andrew Pentis, Senior Writer for Student Loan Hero. You know, Andrew, I'm curious to know what else would be good for folks who have student loans to consider during this payment pause.
Yeah, so the best advice is really catered to your individual situation. So if you are a borrower like we've been talking about that's perhaps struggled to maintain your income, maintain that flexibility in your budget during the pandemic, you might look into those alternative repayment plans and options so that when we get to December or January, you already have a plan in place. You're not going to be rushing around trying to figure out what's next with your student loan repayment, particularly with sort of an expected shuffling of federal loan servicers where many borrowers are going to see their loans transferred to a new servicer. On the other hand, if borrowers out there are, you know, feeling pretty confident about their ability to resume repayment, they might come up with an entirely different plan. They might think about making extra payments on their loans to cut down their debt faster. They might continue to work towards some sort of relief under an existing forgiveness program like public service loan forgiveness or another initiative. They might even consider refinancing their loans if their confidence about mass forgiveness is low and they feel like they can score a low interest rate and really get their debt done with fairly quickly. So the options really do depend on the borrower's situation. And in many cases, you know, their career and where their comfort is with handling debt and having debt for the long term, or if it's something they really want to get rid of as fast as they can.
Well, when it comes to these loans, it's interest free, I believe, on this pause. And Damien, what does that mean for folks? Does it mean that once they're out of the pause program, they're going to get back to the interest? Is it going to be the same rate? Is it going to go higher to make up for these last 2 years of not being charged interest?
They'll return to the interest rate that they had previously. But you do bring up a good point. Since they are paused right now, if you are in the position where you have employment, you are confident in that employment, you have a little bit of margin in your month-to-month cash flow, your emergency fund is stable, you're feeling really good and confident about your stability in the short term, you could potentially put some money towards your student loans now, and it's going to go towards the principal of that balance and knock it down even faster. So if you are looking forward towards trying to eliminate those debts as quick as possible, paying a little on student loans right now might not be the worst idea.
Oh, that's interesting. So instead of just waiting with the pause, if you're able to, you could actually pay a lesser amount because there's no interest charge right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, could the government try to collect the interest later, or is this a done deal?
As far as I know, and the way I've read everything, I think it's been forgiven or just looked over at this point, and they'll be free and clear going forward. We'll pick things back up in February and start the clock again.
And Andrew, you mentioned the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Yes. Essentially, it's an existing federal student loan forgiveness program for folks who work for the government or for eligible nonprofits. And the way the program is currently set up is that if you enroll in an eligible repayment plan and make your at least your minimum monthly payment for 10 years, and you also work in for your eligible employer for 10 years, you would receive relief on your remaining balance after that decade-long mark. This program is far from perfect. It has historically approval rates in the single digits, but it is a focus of the Biden administration, which is actually just beginning regulatory reforms, looking into regulatory reforms of this program to make it more streamlined. One of the improvements that the Biden administration is considering making is awarding relief on an annual basis, and that would help these public servants and nonprofit workers confirm their eligibility and be able to receive relief faster, as opposed to being potentially confused about all these very specific eligibility requirements and then surprisingly not receiving the relief that they had hoped after that 10-year mark.
And when should someone apply for that to check if they're eligible?
Yes. So the way the program is currently set up, you can actually confirm your eligibility using an employment eligibility, certification form. Basically, this is a form you can take into the HR department or your boss at your employer. They can help you fill it out to determine if the employer itself is actually eligible for this program. And once you do that, you can start to track your progress toward the 120 payment mark that you would need to qualify for relief. Essentially, that's 12 monthly payments per year for 10 years. And as long as you're hitting those buckets, you should be able to receive relief.
10 years, that's a long time.
Absolutely. And many borrowers, and I don't blame them, are not really wanting their debt to linger for that long, particularly with the track record of PSLF. So I think, you know, the hope among student loan advocates is that the Biden administration does make some real meaningful changes to PSLF. With that said, regulatory reforms tend to take, you know, 1 to 2 years at the minimum. So this is not going to be an overnight solution. I think the vast majority of federal student loan borrowers don't work for governments or nonprofits, and they're probably having their pinning their hopes on mass forgiveness that doesn't necessarily require them to have a certain type of employment or make a certain number of qualifying payments over such a long period of time.
Right. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, you go to 4 years of college and then you're paying it for 10 years. That's very stressful.
Yes. Yeah, so actually, borrowers are defaulted into a standard repayment plan, which is 10 years. But according to our research at Student Loan Hero, the vast majority of borrowers spend their much longer than 10 years actually getting rid of their debt. And that's just because, you know, as we've talked about, the world of student loan repayment is often very confusing for borrowers who are not necessarily the most financially savvy. So certainly, you know, improving PSLF would be one small corner of this world and making it a little better for a certain subset of borrowers.
Well, we have about a minute left. Damian, do you have anything else that you can add about the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program?
Andrew is right. There has been no shortage of consternation about how the program has been administrated up until this point. I think a lot of people need to make sure they're doing that certification form, employment certification form, annually. But one thing I do want to point out is that the 10 years of payments, or 120 payments in this case, they don't have to be consecutive. So if you miss a payment 5 years into it, that doesn't reset the clock. You can simply pick back up, and once you've achieved those 120 payments, then you'll be eligible.
All right. Well, thank you so much to both of you. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with finance experts about the federal student loan payment pause. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing the federal student loan payment pause. There's a lot to unpack. And if you're looking to pay off loans or thinking of taking some out to pay for school, we have two guests that can answer some of your questions. With us are Damian Dunn, Vice President of Your Moneyline, and Andrew Pentis, Senior Writer for Student Loan Hero. Damian, we were talking about the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. What are some examples of things people should not do when it comes to this program?
I would not wait for that certification that we were talking about previously. If you've never had your employment certified, go ahead and Google PSLF employment certification form. Chances are it'll be one of the first two links that you come to, and print that out and check it out and make sure that you understand what it's asking for. It's really not too terribly demanding on the employee side of the equation. Now, once you get that taken care of and sent and brought into your HR department, they've got more to fill out than you do at that point. So make sure that's being taken care of on an annual basis so that you're getting credit for your employment underneath the program. Because if you don't, and then you apply for that forgiveness down the road, PSLF program is going to look at it and say, well, we don't have any record of you working for a qualified employer. We can't grant you forgiveness. So it's important to make sure that the PSLF program knows that you are working in a qualified job for a qualified employer during this time period, so that when the time comes and those 120 payments are made, you're ready to go. It's really important to stay up on that.
And Andrew, I mean, are you seeing positive changes to student loan forgiveness, let's say in the last decade or so, or is it still very complicated?
Yeah, we've seen sort of the status quo in terms of the number of available programs in recent years. Unfortunately, they do remain complicated in their eligibility requirements, and PSLF is a microcosm of that. I think on the bright side, what we have also seen is that there's been a real increase in the number of state or private loan repayment assistance programs. And these programs are not necessarily, you know, as sexy as forgiveness, because they don't necessarily wipe out 100% of your remaining debt. But for folks in certain careers, they can be hugely beneficial. For example, if you work in a career where you're willing to move to an underserved area and work in your field, you could have a very significant percentage of your debt taken off. So that is a real positive in sort of the world of loan repayment assistance and forgiveness. But certainly we have a long way to go in terms of helping borrowers nationally be able to get some relief on their remaining debt.
Damian, something similar to the PSLF program is an income-driven repayment or IDR plan. Can you tell us more about this?
Sure. There are a number of alternative repayment plans. Andrew's alluded to these in general a couple of times, but it's a way to make sure that your monthly payment is in line with your discretionary income. For a lot of people, the 10-year repayment number is just not feasible, and they need a little bit of relief, a little bit of help to try and make sure they're meeting those obligations on a month-to-month basis. There are, I believe, four, maybe five different options for income-driven repayments, and they have different requirements for each of them. So you'd have to talk to your servicer to see which one makes the most sense for you. But it's a way that you could potentially get a much smaller monthly payment at the expense, however, of stretching that payment out over a number of years, 20, 25 years potentially.
And is it something worth looking into during this payment pause for folks to consider income-driven repayment?
I would certainly make sure that it's on your radar. If you had problems paying your student loans before this pause, check out and see if an income-driven repayment plan might be right for you, to make sure that you are staying current with your obligations and repaying the loans that you took out.
Well, we have a listener voicemail from Carol, who has a question about who services these loans. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Carol from Noblesville, and I recently received a statement from the federal government saying that the loans are going to be serviced by some other organization. So how is that going to affect repayment? Thank you.
All right. Andrew, you want to start?
Absolutely. You know, unfortunately, this is going to cause some headaches and hiccups for borrowers and their repayment. The truth of the matter is that before the pandemic even arrived, a handful of federal loan servicer contracts were set to expire. They've been extended a time or two, but essentially we've already seen some big players in the space, real stalwart federal loan servicers, already announced that they will be leaving the space, including Fed Loan Servicing and Great Lakes, among others. So certainly if you're a borrower out there, including Carol, what you want to do is contact your current federal loan servicer if they haven't contacted you already, and make sure that you understand, where your loan will be transferred to. You also want to make sure they have your most up-to-date contact information, because they're probably going to be sending you correspondence about this transfer. If you want to take it a step further and really be diligent, it'd probably be wise to go to studentaid.gov and download your payment history with your current outgoing federal loan servicer. And that way, if you get to your new servicer and you find that they're telling you your monthly payment or your balance is different than what you'd expected, you now have some proof to go back to them and say, here's my record of payments. So certainly it's not going to be easy for borrowers to navigate this terrain, typically with the end of the extension, the resumption of payments. But hopefully the new administration in the Department of Education will help make this transition a bit easier.
All of this sounds so complicated to me. It just so many different branches that this goes out into. Should someone get an accountant or a financial advisor for these types of scenarios, Damian?
In some cases, you might need help getting some organization of your information going forward, but it should be readily available to you, whether you go to studentaid.gov or check on National Student Loan Data System, NSLDS, to get records, just as Andrew said, and he was right on the money with that answer, to be a little bit proactive and make sure you've got all the right information that you need of everything that you've done up until this point. Once you have that information, it maybe takes just a phone call or two to get a clue of where things are likely headed, which new servicer you're going to have, and then getting set up with whatever systems they've got going forward. So if you are a little unsure of what this looks like, yeah, it never hurts to lean on somebody during this time of transition and make sure that you're doing everything that you need to. But it should be achievable for most people if they feel confident in their abilities to just gather a little bit of data and be organized.
We have another listener voicemail from Christine, who has a question about interest on student loans. Let's take a listen.
My name is Christine. I'm calling from Carmel. And my question is, if a student is currently in college with an unsubsidized federal loan, which is gaining interest when they're in school, is the interest for that loan also put on hold during this time?
All right, Damian?
That's a great question, Andrew. I'm not sure if I've been asked that question. Andrew, do you know what the answer to that question is?
Yes, my understanding is that current students also enjoy the same temporary 0% interest rate. Essentially, the way that normal borrowing works is that if, say, you're a freshman or sophomore and you've borrowed a student loan at, say, 4% interest, the vast majority of in-school borrowers elect to defer their payments while they're in school so that they can focus on their studies, essentially. But in this pandemic, with this extension and interest rates being set to zero, if you borrowed a student loan, then that interest rate is both set to zero, as long as that loan, as Damian mentioned earlier about eligible loans, as long as that loan is eligible. And if it's a direct loan under the federal loan program, your interest rate will be temporarily 0%.
If you started paying it while you're still in school, does that affect anything? I mean, I don't know much about student loans, obviously. That's why I'm asking you guys. But for example, if you're paying it now and then you graduate, is that going to count against you that you didn't wait, I guess, till you're done?
Yes, it's hugely beneficial to make in-school payments. And this is something I'm constantly harping on with new borrowers and families who will be sending their kids to college, is that even making partial in-school payments can help ensure that the balance you face when you leave school, ideally graduating, hasn't ballooned thanks to accruing and capitalizing interest. So, the example I'll always give students is that if you can forego a dinner out every month or perhaps a new pair of jeans and just contribute $25 per month to your federal student loan while you're in school, that will help cut down that interest, perhaps eliminate that interest that is accruing. So that if you borrow a $5,000 student loan as a freshman, you'll have a $5,000 balance when you leave school and enter repayment. So making in-school payments is hugely beneficial and really something that the Department of Education historically financial aid officers historically have done a really poor job of educating families about.
Is there any way, Damien, to put the money aside, as Andrew's mentioning, maybe $25 a month, and have that money grow so that when you do want to pay your loans off, at least it hasn't just been sitting there?
You could put it into a traditional saving account, maybe find an online high yield saving account. The challenge that we run into, however, is that we're looking at such a short term or short time horizon until we plan on needing that money, that it's really risky to put that money in an investment that has any kind of risk exposure at that point. Last thing we want to do is to have a student start saving some money and then have less money when it comes time to put that towards the student loan. So in this case, when you're talking about a very short time horizon until that money is going to be needed, it's probably best to play it safe. And even though you're not going to get spectacular returns, at least you know what's going to be there when you need it.
And Andrew, I know that there have been some scams, just as there always are on the internet with phishing and those kinds of things. Have you noticed anything with pandemic grants or Biden loan forgiveness type things coming to people?
Yes, unfortunately, scammers tend to spring up when borrowers are most vulnerable. And given the context of the pandemic and, you know, an ever worsening student loan crisis, the time is sort of ripe for these scammers. So what you want to be sort of on the lookout for is, if you're a borrower, is anytime someone that you don't know is reaching out to you and promising something that sounds great in exchange for an upfront fee, that's probably too good to be true. So you really want to make sure that whenever you are engaging in correspondence regarding your student loans, you're doing it with your federal loan servicer or with your appointed student loan counselor or other expert, perhaps your financial aid officer on campus. But you really want to make sure that if someone's reaching out to you and perhaps asking for information or money, that you really hold that close to the vest, because student loan forgiveness scams, scams around student loan repayment in general, have sort of always been an issue, but certainly have reached a sort of fever pitch during the pandemic.
Well, speaking of things that are too good to be true, there's been a lot of talk about corporations, Target, for example, announcing they're going to pay full tuition for their employees to go to certain schools or programs. Is that too good to be true?
Yeah, so what I can say is that these programs, typically we judge them by the headline. Target offers free college to employees, and that sounds amazing. If you read the story, if you look into the eligibility requirements of this and other programs like it, you find that the details are a little more limiting. You know, certainly in some cases you need to be perhaps a full-time employee. You need to attend a certain kind of university. You may need to frequent a certain degree track. You might even have to stay with your employer after you've earned your degree. So absolutely, it's a great sign that corporations have decided to more and more start pitching in towards either their employees' current education expenses or student loan repayment. But absolutely, you know, the limiting factors are something that's worth examining before you decide to just go all in onto one of these programs.
And Damien, what are your thoughts in seeing all of these companies come out with this full tuition to get employees?
Tuition reimbursement's been around for a number of years at this point, and I think they are becoming more prevalent, or at least more publicized, basically based on the environment that we find ourselves in. We all know that paying for college is a hot button topic. And if a company, a large company, can get a little bit of good press out of saying that, hey, we're thinking of our employees and we want to make sure that they further their education, we're going to make that known. And yeah, it might be in the employee's very best interest to do this. Absolutely. But like Andrew said, you got to be able to read through all of the offer and make sure that it is in your best interest for your long term.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, I'd like to hear from both of you some final advice on what you think listeners should know who may be struggling with paying off their student loans right now. Andrew, I'll start with you.
Yeah, thank you for that opportunity. I think if you're a borrower who's kind of concerned about this resumption of payments early next year, you know, the best advice is to not wait around. You know, you do have some lead time. That's sort of the gift of this extension. To sort of figure out what is best for you. And as Damien and I have tried to discuss, there are a variety of options. And it's really incumbent upon you and the folks that are hopefully helping you out to sort of figure out what that best option for you is. It could look very different for a former classmate of yours. It could be PSLF or an income-driven repayment plan for you. It could be pausing your loans. It could be improving your credit to the point where you might eventually want to refinance your loans. So certainly ask for help. You know, nobody expects you to know this world of student loans inside and out. Even folks like Damien and I don't know all the answers. So again, you know, like we've said, reach out for help. There are low cost and no cost student loan counselors and credit counselors out there who would be happy to help you, particularly at a time where things are moving really rapidly.
Well, thank you for that. And Damien, what about you?
We know that people are spending considerably more each month right now than they were even a year ago, which makes sense based on the environments that we were in. However, that also means that some of the money that they had normally been sending towards student loans may have been chewed up in other areas right now. So I would suggest, if you haven't looked at where your money's going recently, to get a good handle on what your spending actually reflects at this point. There may be some adjustments, just like Andrew suggested. We've got some runway here. So start making those adjustments now to make sure that you are prepared come February 2022 to resume those student loan payments. And it doesn't have to be a big, scary task. You could start small and make sure that maybe spending in just a couple areas that you know you struggle with on a month-to-month basis, that those are in line. And if you can get those under control, there's a decent chance that you'll be able to pick back up with student loans in a less painful way.
Less painful. That's a good point there. And thank you so much. We'll end on that note. Damien Dunn is vice president of Your Money Line, and Andrew Pentis is a senior writer for Student Loan Hero. Thank you to both of you for joining us this afternoon. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at our phone number, 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam So. Thanks so much for listening. This is All In.